Now, you might remember a couple of weeks ago we spoke to Yvonne Maroney and Donie Ryan about Yvonne's recovery from her addiction. Both Yvonne and Donie are involved in the North Tipperary drugs charity Karma, spelled C-A-R-M-H-A, which stands for Connection and Recovery in Mental Health and Addiction. And Marie was mentioned a lot. She's a psychiatrist. She and Donie set up Karma together, and we decided that we would talk to Marie as well. And she joins me in studio. Marie, up a bone.
Very good.
I've been practicing. Good afternoon, and thanks for coming up. So we've loads of things to talk about, Marie. We'll start with you first. So you're originally from Norway.
I am, yeah.
Why did you come to Ireland?
Oh, I came over here to study medicine back in 2001. I guess I just wanted to study in English and get away from Norway and see the world a little bit. But so I came over here, studied in Trinity, and then I kind of forgot to go home, I guess.
Right. And is that something a lot of people from Norway do?
They do, yeah. It would be fairly common for Norwegians to study abroad. So it would be very much a done thing. It's very much promoted in Norway. So yeah.
But most of them go home after it.
Most of them do. Yes. But I sort of, you know,
okay.
Interestingly, I kind of felt a little bit of the pain of the Irish people. And I was quite fascinated, I think, by that. And
what about us fascinated?
Well, I think, well, first of all, it's, you know, in terms of your outlook on life, I think things were, you know, you're a bit more laid back and a little bit not taking yourselves too seriously. Norwegians are fairly stern and head down, and you know, and the openness of you know, being able to walk down the street and say hello to your next door neighbour or people walking down the street, and that just doesn't happen at home. There's something kind of, was something familiar or something comforting around that, but at the same time, you know, you've, over the years of having lived there, you know, you feel a bit of that oppression, that intergenerational trauma that comes through as a, you know, in the people.
We'll
and the ways of coping, which is clearly one of the things would be
drink,
a bit of crack and a bit of drink, exactly.
Yes,
and
I think it's self-medication.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that a lot in a moment. But just, so you did medicine and then you went into psychiatry.
Yeah.
Why did you choose psychiatry?
I had my own experiences of mental health issues in when I was in college. I took a year out of medicine and did a few other things and tried to get myself back on track again. I had an episode of depression and I kind of had to take a while to sort of figure myself out and where I was going. You know, medicine is obviously tough, and I was here on my own, and very little support and things like that. So yeah, it was a tough old run, and I think that initially sort of scared me away from being interested or doing something that I was actually interested in, which was a mental health beast. But I didn't think I could do it because you know I've had my own difficulties.
Then I guess
as time went by, you know,
I would see that as an advantage.
It is. I see it as an advantage, and it certainly has helped me greatly in my career. I think, you know, seeing working in the hospital medicine, and you're seeing how little time you actually have to, you know, to really hear people, and you know, it's very much around what part of your body is in trouble, not sort of like, well, what goes on in the whole, you know,
yes,
as a whole. Yeah. And I think the pivotal moment was the moment when I was on working in a stroke team in Tala, and we had a lady who had a massive stroke and came in, she was in her 50s, and we were so busy looking after, running around ward rounds, and it wasn't until the day I sit down to discharge her that I realised her husband had died the day before she came in. Right. And had the stroke. And you know, when you, it just kind of went to the core of, you know, yeah, when you're really seeing someone so regularly and you know don't really realise what goes on in people's lives, and how, you know, I just, like, that's not how I want to.
Okay. But you did psychiatry then, and you practiced psychiatry within the HSE.
That's right.
Okay. So give us an example of a typical day. How many referrals would you have of a day as a psychiatrist working in the HSE?
So I guess typically you would run clinics, and, you know, depending on what area you're working in, and obviously there's some regional variations, but by and large, you typically would have about, you know, full clinic, you know, most of the day or half a day, where that would be somewhere between 12 and 20 people in a morning, kind of a thing.
In a morning? So that, is that 9 till lunchtime? Is that 4 hours?
Yeah.
So if you if you had 20 people, that's 5 people an hour. That's 12 minutes each.
That would be, in some areas, that would be typical. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And that's not stopping for a break for a cup of coffee or anything.
No. Okay. So exactly. So, you know.
And these are people with psychiatric problems and mental health problems.
And human suffering, which is immensely complex and, yeah. So, but I mean, it's different when you have a new person, you know, usually when you have a new, that would be kind of a repeat clinic or whatever. And a new, with a new person, you generally have an hour or so with the person.
Would you explain to our listeners about the difference between, you know, the talking model and the medical model? And you, as a as trained as a doctor, and then doing psychiatry within a sort of a medical framework.
Yeah,
that's what you were buying into, really, weren't you? The medical model.
Yeah, that's what I'm trained in.
Yes.
I guess.
So, would you explain that in the vernacular to us?
Well, I guess, you know, psychiatrists are trained to diagnose and treat, I guess, mental illness, you know, in terms of the type of treatment that we have at our disposal is more kind of more of a coordination role in terms of, as well as the medication role. So, you know, we would typically assess somebody and formulate a bit in a diagnosis and then come up with the treatment plan and then, you know, refer to whoever else in the team might be most suitable to take it on. So that often means that, you know, most of the time people should have a go at other types of treatments before medication, say, you know, some talking treatment or other different supports or practical supports or, you know, all of that. But, you know, oftentimes or majority of the time, those supports aren't readily available. And also a lot of people are also on medication at point of entry, or, you know, but when they're referred by their GP, they might have been started on medication already. So the majority of people almost come to the mental health service on medication.
On medication.
Yeah.
And that, of course, to write a prescription takes, you know, less than a minute.
Yeah, well.
Talk therapies are an hour long thing.
Well, I mean, it's, so in our... It's usually an hour if you access psychotherapy or with a psychologist.
Yes.
You know, in terms of deciding on medication, you know, it is a, you know, complicated enough.
Yes,
both
it is.
whether you're, you know, deciding whether to prescribe something or not, or what, or
Okay. So why did you, Marie Uppabowen, leave the HSE?
Yeah. So I guess, for a lot of years, I would have found it very inadequate to, you know, to diagnose people and give them a prescription and off they go. And most of the time, people tend to, you know, go around and around and, you know, not really get to the root of the problem.
Okay.
I found that difficult. It was almost like I feel you prescribing people with a temperature, some paracetamol, but never really, you know, actually, you know, healing, helping people to heal or looking at the bigger picture. So so that, you know, when you're forced to work in ways repeatedly that you sort of, you know, it's a bit of a discord with your own moral beliefs. And also when you feel that you can't treat people the way I would have wanted to be treated myself, because of the complexities of the system, pressures of the system, the way, you know, it's it is a lot of factors that come into play. You know, it's not as easy as, you know, we'd like to work differently, but there's so many barriers to working within the system in a different way, and particularly that in a different sort of more strength-based way with people and supporting people throughout the journey, not just when they're
so unwell. You arrived at a place where what you wanted to do and how you wanted to treat your patients wasn't possible within the framework of the HSE.
Yeah.
Okay, and you decided to leave. So how did you believe that your patients should have been treated?
Well, first of all, I would say they would not be my patients.
Okay, sorry. Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
The people that you see.
Exactly.
I don't like service users either.
No, I know. There is no good way.
There is no good word.
No,
well,
no.
The people you see
then.
Right,
yeah.
The people
yeah.
who come to you. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
So I guess if where I would be coming from is that I would see the role of a trauma and experiences of trauma in people as a very much an underlying factor in a lot of mental health issues and addiction issues. And I think, you know, not that you need to provide trauma treatment to people. I think people kind of mistake it for when you talk about something called trauma-informed care. They think, oh, you have to treat everybody's trauma. But I think, you know, the way I wanted to work was very much around having an acknowledgement of that there are a lot of people experiencing trauma, and that a lot of mental health issues and addiction issues and the way people present to our services are rooted in that and are typically ways of coping or managing emotions or trying to regulate emotions or lack of regulating emotions, and that, you know, comes out in different ways.
Okay. So we hear about self-medication when it comes to drugs.
Yeah.
I've come to know what getting out of your head actually means. So it's to try and numb the pain.
Yeah.
It's to get out of this place, this space in your head, which is causing you terrible turmoil, and it's just not a nice place to be. So people numb themselves.
Yeah.
They anaesthetize themselves with drink and drugs. Right. So there's no point in adding more medication to that then, is there?
There is always a role for medication, right. And I wouldn't advocate for no medication at all. But the problem is that people tend to, without being fully informed of the effects of them, and also people tend to start relying on them quite a lot, because the message that typically we are sending to people is that you're unwell, you're sick, you have this thing that you're not going to recover from, and you need to keep coming back and taking your medication, yes. Otherwise you're not going to get better. Whereas human beings have an incredible innate ability to heal and to recover, you know, themselves. It's just that they need support to do that. So it's, you know.
And the structures within the HSE aren't built for that sort of treatment.
No, and I think what typically would happen, particularly with people who have experienced trauma, is that it's very easy to, you know, to get re-traumatized by certain patterns within the system of, you know, things like, you know, being rejected or placed on a waiting list or not validated in terms of their, you know, if you tell someone that actually what you have now is a disease X, Y, and Z, that's what's wrong with you, and not sort of, well, actually all those horrendous things that you've gone through in your life or the difficulties you've experienced, that sort of doesn't matter because it's this disease, you know.
Yes.
When that is the narrative that you're faced with, then you also stop believing in your own ability to...
Well, let's tease out, say, you know, mental health issues and addiction.
Yeah.
And one of the things we talked to Donny about, who yourself and Donny set up Karma, was this dual diagnosis when it comes to addiction and mental health issues. And that for a lot of the time that people were, if they had addiction, they were told by the mental health services, we can't treat you until you're sober.
Yeah.
And when they become sober, of course, their mental health issues are exasperated because the pain they're trying to numb re-emerges. So that doesn't work for them. So there should be some sort of situation where you can treat both in parallel. Does that not exist?
Well, parallel actually sort of, it does exist, but parallel means typically like actually separate,
but at the same time. But never the train should meet. Okay, yes.
Exactly. What you're talking about is probably integrated, really.
Integrated, sorry, yes.
So
like temporarily, they're happening at the same time, but they're not integrated.
Typically, people might go to the addiction service for their addiction problem and mental health for mental health problems, and then there is lack of communication and joined up thinking, and or that it is back to the old way, which is serial kind of model of treating things where you deal with one first and then the other.
That's sort of outdated now. But does it still happen in Ireland?
Outdated, but still happening.
Still
very
happening
much
in Ireland.
So.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Is it not accepted, and this statistic came up when we were talking to Donny,
that
over 70% of addiction problems are caused by some sort of childhood trauma? Is that not scientifically accepted now? No.
Well, I think the difficulty is that it depends on how you define trauma.
Right.
And
how would you define trauma?
So, like, typically, you'd think in terms of like medical model, it'd be in terms of diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder, for example. You know, it needs to be quite significant trauma to qualified
to register,
but the reality is that a lot of trauma isn't really what happened to you; it's the experience of that event within yourself and in how you interpret that situation and how, you know,
okay,
yeah, cope
yes,
with it.
Yes, yes, so, yes. So one person's trauma may not be trauma for somebody else.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there are things that are, like, nobody would disagree that they're traumatic, like,
of course,
you know, childhood sexual abuse,
exactly,
physical abuse,
yeah,
neglect. They're
and
all
we do
things.
Know that, you know, the more what we call adverse childhood experiences that you experience, the higher the risk of developing, you know, both addiction, mental health issues, physical health issues, and later in life. And
some of these traumas can happen at such a young age that people may not be aware of them consciously.
Absolutely. And that's what's interesting as well. When you say, well, what's the rate of how many people have experienced trauma? I think there's so many people who experience trauma who don't realise that it's trauma. And I know Yvonne was talking about that last time she was there, you know, in terms of she didn't put the connection between her addiction issues and her experiences. So when you say, well, you know, have you experienced anything traumatic in your life? A lot of people would say, no, I had a really great, happy childhood. It's not really happened to me. But oftentimes that's all in context of what's normal in some people's lives or, you know, and others, you know, that and how they interpret that situation.
Oprah Winfrey and this guy, Dr. Perry, have a new book called What Happened to You?
Mm.
And we spoke to Edith Eger recently as well. She's an Auschwitz survivor.
Mm.
And she's a psychotherapist, I think. And her question to people is, when did you stop being a child?
Yes.
Those questions are similar, aren't they?
Yeah.
So there seems to be a sort of a school of thought now that's all converging on this trauma theory for mental health and addiction issues.
It's big, you know, I guess it's huge awareness in recent years around it, which is good. I think it's followed on from sort of, you know, we talked about recovery oriented care within mental health and reform of our services and things. And that is sort of now moving and shifting in towards more trauma informed care. It's very much, you know, I know Gabor Maté also speaks to saying it's not what happened to you or it's not what's wrong with you.
It's what happened to you. Yeah,
exactly. But
so practically speaking, if it's trauma-based care.
Trauma-informed
care, sorry. Mm-hmm. That's labour-intensive, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing. It does require a certain amount of resources to be able to work with people. And I guess that's the difficulty. But at the same time, you know, I guess it's in the long run. Treat people, you keep seeing people revolving through our doors, and all the costs of that, you know, in terms of how people present in other services as well, not just in the mental health services, but across the board in terms of acute services and criminal justice systems. You know,
do you think people who are studying medicine now, do you think they're being taught about trauma-informed recovery and treatment?
I do not think so, Rick,
no.
But
and
there
the
should
people,
be, in
the
my
people,
opinion.
But they're the people who are going out into the HSE.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you felt so strongly about this, Marie, that you turned your back on a permanent pensionable job in the HSE with prospects of promotion and increase in salary, consultancy. Yeah. You know, whatever that is, 150 to 200,000 euro.
Yeah.
To set up Karma.
Yeah. That's right. I guess.
You're not even a native of this country.
No, maybe that's a good thing.
Is it? Yeah.
I know, sure. I think when you believe in something, you know, I'm obviously clearly not financially driven in that sense.
No.
That, but, you know, when you, I think, you know, I also have a brother who's in recovery now, but is in addiction. And even in a country like Norway, you know, you see the similar, challenges around accessing care and the right help and back home in Norway. So, it's something that I've been passionate about for a long time. And then I, you know, started working with Donny within the HSA, and we had very similar kind of ideas around, you know, frustrations around how people were being treated within the system in terms of dismissed and blamed and excluded and, you know, people struggle to access any help. people with addiction and mental health issues. So that's, I guess, coupled with that, we did some research in our needs assessments and looked at what people actually want and feel they need. And then we got together with a group of people with the addiction and mental health issues themselves. There was a bunch of family members and the local community and everybody. There was such a hunger to do something. Yes. So that's it. Sort of developed quite organically, and that kind of, I guess, spurred
working.
Us on. So yeah, it's been a long, hard journey, clearly, and obviously this last year has made
helped,
it a challenging situation. You know, even more challenging. So, but what you see is that when you do. You know, like, I mean, the whole thing around Karma is that we have, you know, it's a free service and we have it's easy access to some help and some care in a non-judgmental, you know, environment. Yeah. And that makes a huge difference.
And you have people like Yvonne who were there
like Yvonne,
to welcome you in and
exactly.
say, I know what you're going through. I've been there too.
Yeah. So we have peer support workers or people with lived experience. Yeah.
And can
with
people
us.
Recover from childhood trauma?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And part of it is that love and affection and acceptance, isn't it?
Yeah, that sounds a little bit hippie now, Ray, but but you know,
but here's the problem. this is a problem though, isn't it? Because it's self-fulfilling, because if you train people up in the medical model, and they go into positions of power in the HSE, they only recognise that as the way of doing things. They don't recognise what you and Donny are doing down in Karma.
But I think people don't get the opportunity. You don't see recovery happening and healing happen within the four walls of an office. Do you know what I mean? So like what I felt it made a difference to me is that you need to get out there and hear people and actually listen without intention of treating or doing anything, you know, but actually listen and also see people in a different environment within the community. You see that people have incredible, you know, potential and skills. People who would have come in and out of my office who I kind of thought, oh Jesus, they'd never get better, you know?
Yeah.
But actually you see them in a different environment and people do get better. Mm. People do go on and do amazing things. And like Yvonne, obviously.
The vision for change was there. And now they have sharing the vision. And one of the sort of the building blocks of that, both of those documents, was these community mental health teams, which were supposed to be teams of psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, psychologists and all within the community working out of primary care centres.
Yeah.
Have you seen that on the ground?
Well, that I guess that is how the structure of our services are. They are mainly community-based. But
yours are, yes.
In general, the HSE mental health services are community-based services around the country, and then you'd cover inpatient care at the same time. But obviously we close down all the major hospitals a lot.
Yes.
For good and bad, but you know, it's the difficulty is obviously recession hit and we didn't have enough, you know, funding to actually properly fund the community care that was.
Yeah. So what happened was we saw American doing this, taking everybody out of institutions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this community care model.
Yeah.
But we weren't prepared to do it properly.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
We're in some sort of no man's land.
So
now.
Often what happens then is that the people who used to be in psychiatric institutions are now in prison. You know, typically would happen. You know, there's a migration towards that. But
so there's a huge amount of trauma among prisoners as well.
Massive, huge. And you can imagine the re-traumatization that people are experiencing within
prison.
Those
There's
systems.
No hope, really.
So, but you know, there is...
Yeah, and what about just on the, if, you know, to be play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
If you accept that childhood trauma, you know, brings you to addiction because you want to self-medicate or whatever, does that let you off the hook in a way, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that argument that,
no, but
that sort of, oh, that we're meant to be all, you know, oh, well, they...
Poor them,
they don't know better and like that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
I think that is kind of seeing it in the wrong light. That's not trauma-informed care, to just sort of say, well, you know, they can't help it, so we let everything, you know.
I think
that is not really the point in it. What we see is that typically, like, when you're actually engaged with people in a, you know, really humane way, in a really compassionate way, and you develop that kind of rapport with people, you know, you start building trust. And by and large, when you've experienced childhood trauma, you don't trust anybody.
Anybody, no.
So a lot of the behaviours that you see that are like might be challenging for people
or whatever,
are absolutely vital coping skills for survival a lot of the time. But like that, what was I saying now?
Yeah, the message from us today is that what you do should be included in the HSE. It's unlikely to happen. They're constantly looking for solutions, and they have a pilot, a sort of ready-made pilot in Karma, which they should probably roll out, but they don't have Marie and Donies all over the country, so they have to be trained up, and it takes a certain person of, you know, with a certain attitude that not everybody has, and that's a problem as well. Anyway, we will talk about this again. We've run out of time. It's something we'll come back to.
Great stuff.
And that book I mentioned, which is I've read most of it over the last couple of nights. What Happened to You? It's Dr. Perry and Oprah Winfrey, and it's laid out in the vernacular, and it's conversational, and people will understand it.
Yeah.
And it's about how trauma affects mental health and brings us to addiction. Marie Apobuin, thank you very much for coming in. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.